pitching new stories and promoting myself to new audiences. I received more benefit of the doubt as an unknown regional theater critic than I do as an internationally published political columnist. What could I have accomplished by now if I had just been allowed to write? Who could I have been? I sometimes think of people's personalities as the negative space around their insecurities. Afraid of intimacy? Cultivate aloofness. Feel invisible? Laugh loud and often. Drink too much? Play the gregarious basket case. Hate your body? Slash and burn others so you can climb up the pile. We construct elaborate palaces to hide our vulnerabilities, often growing into caricatures of what we fear. The goal is to move through the world without anyone knowing quite where to dig a thumb. It's a survival instinct. When people know how to hurt you, they know how to control you. But when you're a fat person, you can't hide your vulnerability because you are it and it is you. Being fat is like walking around with a sandwich board that says, "Here's where to hurt me." That's why reclaiming fatness, living visibly, declaring, "I am fat and I am not ashamed," is a social tool so revolutionary, so liberating, it saves lives. Unfortunately, my first troll, the first time an anonymous stranger called me fat online, was years before I discovered fat liberation. It was posted in the comments of some innocuous blog entry on June 9th, 2009 at 11:54 p.m., what would become a major turning point in my life. I'm guessing Lindy's sexual fantasies involve aliens that love big girls and release a hallucinogenic gas while making sweet love to a fat girl that instantly causes her to imagine herself as height-weight proportionate with long, sexy legs. The comment was so jarring because it was so specific. It wasn't simply dashed off in a rage. It took some thought, some creativity, some calibration. Calories were burned. The subtext that got its hooks in me the most was, "I know what you look like," implying that the author was either someone I knew who secretly despised me, or a stranger fixated enough to take the time to do research on my body. Only slightly less unsettling, the comment simultaneously sexualized me and reminded me that fat women's sexuality can only ever be a ghoulish parody. I cried. I went home early, feeling violated, and climbed into bed to marathon some SVU. I'd always known that my body was catnip for dicks, but up until that moment, writing had been a refuge. On paper, my butt size couldn't distract from my ideas. It hadn't even occurred to me that my legs weren't long enough. I added it to the list. That night, I forwarded that comment to my editors and the tech team, begging for some sort of change in the comment moderation policy. How was this not a hostile work environment? How was it not gendered harassment? These people were my friends, they still are, but the best they could give me was a sympathetic brow knit and a shrug. The internet's a cesspool, that's just the internet. We all get rude comments. Can't make an internet without getting a little internet on your internet. Why, though? Why is invasive, relentless abuse that disproportionately affects marginalized people who have already faced additional obstacles just to establish themselves in this field something we should all have to live with just to do our jobs? 6 years later, this is still a question I've yet to have answered. At pretty much every blogging job I've ever had, I've been told by male managers that the reason is money. It would be a death sentence to moderate comments and block the IP addresses of chronic abusers, because it shuts down discourse and guts traffic. I've heard a lot of lectures about the importance of neutrality. Neutrality is inherently positive, I'm told. If we start banning trolls and shutting down harassment, we'll all lose our jobs. But no one's ever shown me any numbers that support that claim, that harassment equals jobs. Not that I think traffic should trump employee safety anyway, but I'd love for someone to prove to me that it's more than just a cop-out. Years later, when I moved on to a staff writer position at Jezebel, and trolls like Sex Alien Guy had become a ubiquitous potpourri, Gawker Media publisher Nick Denton unrolled a new platform called Kinja, with the express mission of investing in commenters. On Kinja, any commenter could start their own blog, hosted by Gawker, which could then be mined for reposting on the main sites. Your commenter handle became the URL of your blog, so, for example, mine was lindywest.kinja.com. This was an alarming precedent from an editorial standpoint. Our employer was intentionally blurring the lines between our work as professional, experienced, vetted, paid journalists and the anonymous ramblings of the unpaid commentariat, which seemed to exist most days simply to antagonize us. It did not go over particularly well at the all-hands meeting. In Kinja, as the trolls quickly learned, comments are moderated by the writers, so to keep our work readable, we had to dismiss and ban each one by hand. At Jezebel, that meant fielding a constant stream of GIFs depicting graphic violence and rape. It was emotionally gruesome, but it was part of the job. The problem with handing anonymous commenters the tools of their own legitimization soon became even clearer for me. One user registered the handle Lindy West Licks My Asshole and began merrily commenting all over Gawker. Under Kinja, that meant there was now a permanent blog hosted by my employer, side by side with my work, called lindywestlicksmyasshole.kinja.com. Can you imagine? At your job? That's like if your name was Dave Jorgensen and you worked at Walgreens, and one day you got to work, and right in between the fiber supplements and the seasonal candy, there was a new aisle called Dave Jorgensen is a Sex Predator. And when you complained to your manager, she was like, oh, you're so sensitive. It's a store. We can't change what goes in a store. We'd go out of business. We all have stuff we don't like, Dave. I don't like salt and vinegar Pringles, but you don't see me whining about aisle two. I emailed my boss and insisted the page be taken down. She told me she'd see what she could do, but not to get my hopes up. Sure enough, Gawker higher-ups claimed it didn't violate the harassment policy. It isn't explicitly gendered or racist or homophobic. Anyway, that's just how the internet is. If we start deleting comments because people's feelings are hurt, it'll stifle the lively comment culture that keeps the site profitable. What if Lindy West Licks My Asshole has some really tasty anonymous tip about a congressman who did something weird with his penis? Don't you care about free speech and penis news? It is gendered, though. Of course it's gendered. It's sexualizing me for the purpose of making me uncomfortable, of reminding my audience and colleagues and detractors that I'm a sex thing first and a human being second, that my ideas are secondary to my body. Sure, if you strip away cultural context entirely, you could construe Lindy West Licks My Asshole as having nothing to do with gender, but that's willful dishonesty. Footnote, I did once receive an angry email from a man informing me that asshole is an anti-male slur, which is about the level of understanding of female anatomy that I'd expect from someone who believes in reverse sexism. Just kidding, women poop out of our vaginas like a parrot. I didn't have a choice, however, so I put Lindy West Licks My Asshole out of my mind and tried to stay out of the comments as much as possible. It's just the internet. There's nothing we can do. When I was right in that sweet spot, late Stranger, early Jezebel, when the trolls were at full volume about my Michelin Man thorax and Dalek thighs, but my only line of defense was the fetal position, I was effectively incapacitated. I had no coping mechanisms. I felt helpless and isolated. I stayed in bed as much as possible and kept the TV on 24/7. I couldn't fall asleep in silence. I don't know if trolls say to themselves explicitly, I don't like what this lady wrote. I'm going to make sure she never leaves her apartment. But that's what it does to the unprepared. I know those early maelstroms pushed some of my friends away. To someone who's never experienced it, large-scale online hate is unrelatable, and complaints about it can read like narcissism. Ugh, what do I do with all this attention? The times I did manage to get out and socialize, it was hard not to be a broken record, to recount tweets I'd gotten that day like a regurgitating toilet. Eventually, people got bored. Who wants to sit around in person and talk about the internet? Gradually, though, it took years, I got better. I learned how to weather the mob without falling out of my skin, becoming my own tedious shadow. Plan A. Don't click on anything. Don't read anything. Don't look at any words below any article or any forum to which the public has any access, or any email with a vaguely suspicious subject line like feedback on your work, or a questions about women, or feminism equals female supremacy? Ever. Because why on earth would you do that? I can understand if the internet had just been invented Tuesday and you sincerely thought, oh, perhaps Sniff My Chode 89 has some constructive perspective on the politics of female body hair. However, I, Lindy West, have now been using this virtual garbage dispenser for literally 20 years. And maybe one comment in 50 contains anything other than condescending, contrarian, and/or abusive trash. I have no excuse. When I click, it is because I am a fool. It's as if there were an international chain of delis that no matter what franchise you went to and what you ordered and how clearly you articulated pastrami, 49 out of 50 times they just served you a doo-doo sandwich, a big, fat, steaming scoop of doo-doo on a sesame seed bun, special sauce, doo-doo. Then you went ahead and ate the sandwich. And you didn't just eat the sandwich one time, or 50 times, or even 100, but you went back and ate there, with hope in your heart, paying for the privilege, every single day of your life. Thousands and thousands of days in a row. Plus, pretty much everyone you ever met had been to that deli too, and they all ate mouthfuls of straight, stank doo-doo over and over again, and they told you about it. They warned you. Yet you still went back and ate the sandwich. Because maybe this time it'd be different. Maybe, just maybe, this time you'd get the most delicious and fulfilling sandwich the world had e'er known, and the sandwich guy would finally recognize the trenchant, incisive brilliance of your sandwich-ordering skills, and doo-doo would be abolished, and Joss Whedon would pop out of the meat freezer and hand you a trophy that said, Best Guy on it, and option your sandwich story for the plot of the next Avengers movie, Captain Whatever the Sandwich Soldier. Full disclosure, I do not know what an Avenger is. That's not what happens, though. That's never what happens. Instead, I keep slogging through 49 iterations of Kill Yourself, Pig Lady, per day in my Twitter mentions because one time in 2013, Holly Robinson Pete replied to my joke about Carnation Instant Breakfast. Footnote, this actually did happen. I would not joke about Holly Robinson Pete. Cool cost-benefit analysis, brain. Still, I try not to click. I try. Plan B. When the temptation is too strong, when Plan A falls in the commode, I turn to the second line of defense, the mock and block. I take screen grabs of the worst ones, the ones that wish for my death, the ones that invoke my family, the ones with a telling whiff of pathos, and then repost them with a caption like, Way to go, Einstein, or Goo Goo Gaga, baby man, or sometimes just a picture of some diaper rash cream. As Dorothy Parker, or someone like that, probably once said, Goo Goo Gaga Baby Man is the soul of wit. My friends and I will toss the troll around for a while like a pod of orcas with a baby seal, and once I've wrung enough validation out of it, I block the troll and let it die alone. Maybe it's cruel. I know that trolls are fundamentally sad people. I know that I've already defeated them in every substantive arena, by being smart, by being happy, by being successful, by being listened to, by being loved. Whatever. Maybe if Mr. Kill Yourself, You Fat Piece of Shit didn't want to get mocked, shredded, and discarded, he should be more careful about how he talks to whales. Plan C. Wine. Overall, my three-pronged defense holds up pretty well. I am okay. I cope day to day, and honestly, there's something seductive about being the kind of person who can just take it. Challenging myself to absorb more and more hate is a masochistic form of vanity. The vestigial allure of a rugged individualism that I don't even believe in. No one wants to need defenses that strong. It always hurts, somewhere. Besides, armor is heavy. My ability to weather online abuse is one of the great tragedies of my life. You never get used to trolls. Of course you're an adaptable thing. Your skin thickens, your stomach settles. You learn to tune out the chatter. You cease self-Googling, mostly. But it's always just a patch, a screen, a coat of paint. It's plopping a houseplant over the dry rot. It's emotional hypothermia. Your brain can trick itself into feeling warm, but the flesh is still freezing. Medically speaking, your foot's still falling off. There's a phenomenon called paradoxical undressing, common when a person dies of hypothermia, wherein they become so convinced they're overheating that they peel off all their clothes and scatter them in the snow. They get colder. Die faster. There's something uncanny about a cold death, a still indifferent warping of humanity. I struggle to conceive of the resilience I've developed in my job as a good thing, this hardening inside me, this distance I've put between myself and the world, my determination to delude myself into normalcy. From the cockpit, it feels like much more of a loss than a triumph. It's like the world's most not-worth-it game show. Well, you've destroyed your capacity for unbridled happiness and human connection, but don't worry. We've replaced it with this prison of anxiety and pathological inability to relax. Yet, it seems like the more abuse I get, the more abuse I court, bearing myself more extravagantly, professing opinions that I know will draw an onslaught. Because, after all, if I've already adjusted my body temperature, why not face the blizzard so that other women don't have to freeze? Paradoxical undressing, I guess. But it's just the internet. There's nothing we can do. This is my reality now, Pretty much every day, at least one stranger seeks me out to call me a fat bitch, or some pithy variation thereof. Being harassed on the internet is such a normal, common part of my life that I'm always surprised when other people find it surprising. You're telling me you don't have hundreds of men popping into your cubicle in the accounting department of your mid-sized regional dry goods distributor to inform you that, you're too fat to rape, but perhaps they'll saw you up with an electric knife. No? Just me, then. This is the barbarism, the eager abandonment of the social contract, that so many of us face simply for doing our jobs. I'm aware of the pull all the time. I should change careers. I should shut down my social media. Maybe I can get a job in print somewhere. It's just too exhausting. I hear the same refrains from my colleagues. Not only that, but those of us who are hardest hit often wind up writing about harassment itself. I never wanted internet trolls to be my beat. I wanted to write feminist polemics, jokes about wizards, and love letters to John Goodman's meaty sexual forearms. I still want that. I wonder if I'll ever be able to get back to work. Strong people fighting against the elements. I never wanted to fight virtual trolls. I wanted to fight real ones. With a sword. My fixation on the fantastical is not difficult to trace. When I was very small, my dad read out loud to me every night before bed. It was always fantasy. Tolkien, Lewis, Baum, Tolkien again. I remember him nodding off in the chair, his pace and pitch winding down like he was running out of batteries. Biffer, boffer, bomber. To this day, if someone even mentions riding a barrel down the Seldu into Lake Town at the gates of Erebor in the Lonely Mountain, even if they're just talking about spring break, I am incapacitated by nostalgia. I made him read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe so many times that I could recite much of it from memory. I didn't know what air raids were, but I knew that when they happened, you went on a permanent vacation to a country manse where a wizard let you use his interdimensional closet. I wonder if we can get air raids in Seattle, I thought. Dad was a jazz pianist and an ad copywriter, an expressive baritone who was often employed as a kind of one-man, full-service jingle factory. By night, he worked in bars, sometimes 7 nights a week, a lost breed of lounge entertainer who skipped dizzyingly from Standards to Flanders and Swan to Lord Buckley and back again. Once in a while, I still meet Seattle old-timers who blush like teenagers. I loved your dad. Used to go see him every night. My grandfather was a radio producer, the Burns and Allen Show, Lucky Strike Hit Parade, and in the 1940s, when he took a job at CBS, it was suggested that he change his name from the unwieldy and, perhaps at the time, uncomfortably Austrian Reckenmacher to the more radio-friendly West. So my dad became Paul West Jr., and now I am Lindy West. Sometimes people think Lindy West is a pseudonym. I guess they're right. 80 years removed, my grandparents' old Hollywood existence seems impossibly glamorous. I imagine shimmering laughter and natty suits. Hats on heads, hats in hat boxes, scotch in the winter, gin in the summer. Grandma Winnie sang with Meredith Wilson's orchestra, and when my dad was a little boy in the 30s, she worked in movies, under her maiden name Winnie Parker and her stage name Mona Lowe, dubbing the vocal parts for Carol Lombard, Dolores Del Rio, and other leading ladies who apparently couldn't sing. Dad had stories of going to Shirley Temple's birthday party, of nearly fainting when his dad nonchalantly introduced him to his friend Lou Costello, of Gene Autry trying to give little Paul a pony to keep in their Glendale backyard. They drank hard, eating and drinking and carrying on, as my dad would say. He once emailed me a little vignette he wrote in his creative writing night class. Quote, "The living room is the part of the house I remember least, from the inside anyway. I remember it a little better from the sidewalk in front along Kenneth Road. I remember standing there looking at the bright gold harp that stood framed by the green brocade draperies, draperies I once hid behind when my mother and father were screaming drunk. I heard a dull thunk, followed by a big crash, and when I peeked out from behind the drape, my father was lying on the living room floor, blood spurting from his big, already knobby nose. Mother and the other couple in the room, my uncle and his wife, were laughing hysterically when my grandmother came down the wide staircase. "Was ist?" she said, with stern Viennese dignity. "An orange," my uncle giggled. "Winnie hit him in the nose with an orange." They were all helpless with laughter. "Be ashamed," Grandma said. Footnote. There's more. Quote, I called my blanket Hi-Ho. It didn't follow me everywhere, but it was the comfort I sought when fear and injury came. On the day of the car accident on the way to the preschool, I had Hi-Ho with me. It was forever stained with my blood, and while it remained beside me in my crib at night after it had been washed, the brown stains remained and tarnished the magic. The warmth was still there, but the reassurance was gone. A year or so later, we named our new Cocker Spaniel Hi-Ho. I never met any of those people. In fact, I've never met any family from my dad's side at all. My grandfather had a heart attack and died unexpectedly in 1953 when he was just 44, 2 days before my dad's high school graduation. There was some dispute about the burial between the deeply Catholic Reckonmachers in southern Illinois who wanted a Catholic funeral and my dad's lapsed Hollywood branch who didn't. Paul West Sr. ended up in a Catholic cemetery in Culver City, where lingering animus led to nobody visiting him for the next 55 years, until, on a whim, my sister and I tracked down the grave. We called Dad and told him where we were. "Golly," he said, his voice rough. You could tell that my dad never fully recovered from that loss, and it wasn't his last. My sister and I called him Sad Dad. Underneath the exuberance, there was a towering melancholy. I sometimes told people that my dad reminded me of Robin Williams, and they would assume I meant the drive to entertain, the old showbiz patter, but it was really that ever-present pigpen cloud of kind-eyed sadness. My dad had 4 wives. My mom was the last. I think about how much faith it must have taken to keep going, to insist over and over again, "No, I really think it's going to work this time." Plenty of people are irretrievably jaded after 1 divorce, let alone 3. My dad went for it 4 times, and the last one stuck. You could frame that as irresponsibility or womanizing or a fear of being alone, but to me it was a distillation of his unsinkable optimism. He always saw the best in everyone. I imagine, likewise, he stood at the beginning of every romance and saw it unspooling in front of him like a grand adventure, all fun and no pain. "Oh boy," I can hear him saying each time. "Isn't she just terrific?" The idea that a relationship is a failure simply because it ends is a pessimist's construct anyway. Dad loved lots of people, and then found the one he loved the best. It made sense that he was so drawn to magic and escapism just like me. His life was beautiful and marked with loss. Maybe not more than anyone else's, but when you only expect the best, heartbreak is a constant. My mom, by contrast, never liked fantasy. When I was little, this made as much sense to me as not liking Gravity or Gordon from Sesame Street. "I just like things that are true," she'd say. "Strong people, fighting against the elements." I grilled her so often on why she wasn't obsessed with dragons like a normal person that it became kind of a catchphrase in our house. Strong people fighting against the elements. That made sense, too. My mom's parents came from Norway. Grandma Clara first, the eldest of 10, when she was a little girl and the family homesteaded in North Dakota. We visited the old dirt farm once during a family reunion, just a hole and the remnants of the foundation and some dead grass and the big red sun. In summer, the North Dakotan prairie is flat and brown. In winter, flat and white. The elements, I imagine, had a seat at the table like family. When the Depression hit and my great-grandparents just couldn't feed so many mouths, they shipped 18-year-old Clara back to Norway to raise 2 of her little sisters on her own. While Grandpa Reckonmacher's early death shaped my dad's life like a tide, absent mothers tugged on my mom's side. My great-aunt Eleanor, one of the little girls sent off to the old country, requested that "Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child" be played at her funeral, and it was. Clara met and married my grandfather, Ole, who grew up on a farm called Gunnarsveen, just down the lake. His father died in the flu pandemic of 1918, when Ole was 9. The boys didn't have much of a childhood, my mom told me once, when she emailed to scold me about washing my hands during the 2009 swine flu scare. Subject line, germs. Footnote, body of email. My rules are, wash your hands as soon as you get home, then go around with a Clorox wipe and clean the doorknobs, light switches, and faucets. Of course, wash before you eat and keep your hands away from your mucous membranes, including eyes. I wish I could quarantine you until this thing settles down, but I will trust you to keep yourself safe. If everybody in your house does the same, then you can feel safe at home. Unless you accidentally let a sick person inside. Love you, Mom. In 1945, during the Nazi occupation, Grandpa Ole and his brother were among 12 resistance fighters who skied out into the dark hills to retrieve packages parachuted by an Allied spy plane, bundles of weapons, radio equipment, provisions. Strong people, elements, blah blah blah, the whole thing. Ole and Clara married and moved to Seattle and raised 7 children. My mom, Ingrid, was number 6. Clara kept house, canning fruit, sewing the family's clothes, a pot of coffee perpetually perking for anyone who dropped by. And Grandpa Ole was a carpenter, never quite mastering English because, privately, he always just wanted to go home. They took in strays. Sometimes as many as 13 people lived in that 3-bedroom, 1-bath house. The kids shared beds and bathwater. My trick was to help my mother in the kitchen, my mom always says when someone compliments her cooking. It was hard to get one-on-one time otherwise. She was so busy. Maybe that's why my mom stopped at one child herself. She speaks of the cramped chaos with pride. Her ability to get by is part of her identity. My mother is aggressively competent. She was an RN for 40 years. Yes, she will look at your infected toe. And her rigid expectations about the correct way to do things border on disordered. Motto, if you clean your bathroom every day, you never have to clean your bathroom. When she and my dad fell in love, he was playing the piano in bars every night, living off credit cards, occasionally accepting gin and tonics as currency, and had decorated his apartment entirely in zebra-themed bric-a-brac, due no doubt to some passing impetuous whim. Hey, zebras are trick! By the time I was born a few years later, they were financially stable, he had a day job at an ad agency, and the zebra merch was limited to 1 vase, 2 paintings, a set of director's chairs, and a life-sized F.A.O. Schwartz stuffed zebra named Simon. You know, a reasonable amount. He wrote a song for my mom called, I Like You So Much Better Than Anyone I've Ever Loved Before. Time was I took a lot of chances on passions and romances, but you're the one who helped me get my feet back on the floor. That's why I like you so much better than anyone I've ever loved before. Dad was the entertainer, but I'm funny because of my mom. She has a nurse's ease with gallows humor, sarcastic and dry. She taught me to cope with pain by chopping it up into bits small enough to laugh at. My dad would go full swamps of sadness when anything went wrong. If the printer ran out of toner, he couldn't speak above a whisper for days. When I was little, a neighbor opened a small temping agency called Multitask, and in an early stab at guerrilla marketing, purchased a vanity plate that read, MLTITSK. Around the house, my mom called him M.L. Titsky. Later, just Mr. Titsky. Empirically, that's a great riff. Once at a block party, she forgot that Mr. Titsky wasn't actually his name and introduced him as such to a new neighbor. Mr. Titsky, it turned out, was not a comedy connoisseur. My dad took care of unbridled enthusiasm and unconditional encouragement. Everything was killer, wow-wee, you can be anything you want to be. While my mom's role was, not today. And not if you don't learn how to balance a checkbook. Footnote, still haven't. Only 20% clear on the definition, to be honest. In fact, she recently told me that part of her parenting philosophy was to make sure I knew I couldn't be anything. Well, you can't, she said. I didn't want you to be disappointed. If my dad supported us with words, head in the clouds, my mom supported us with structure, roots in the ground. That degree of harmonious opposition has to fulfill some cosmic archetype. Not that my mom would allow such arcane silliness to be discussed in her house. Between those far-flung poles, escapism versus realism, glamour versus austerity, wild hope versus Nordic practicality, I grew. People say to me all the time, I couldn't do what you do. I couldn't cope with trolls. But it's just part of my job. I bet they could if they had to. Once in a while, though, I wonder, is it more than that? Did I somehow stumble into a job, one that didn't even exist when I was born in 1982, for which I am supremely preternaturally suited? I do fight monsters, just like I always dreamed, even if they are creeps in basements who hate women, instead of necromancers in skull towers who hate lady knights. Without my mom, would I have the grit to keep going? Without my dad, would I have the idealism to bother? The day I didn't fit. One time, I flew first class on an airplane, because when I checked in, they offered me a $50 upgrade, And when you are a fat person with $50 and somebody offers you a 21-inch recliner instead of a 17-inch trash compactor, you say yes. It was a new world up there in front of that little magic curtain among the lordlings. I was seated next to a businessman in leather shoes that cost more than my car, and behind a man who kept angrily attempting to sell a boat over the phone even after they told us to stop making phone calls. The first rule of first class, apparently, is that there are no rules. The second rule is don't let the poor people use the rich people bathroom. I wondered if my fellow first classers, all virility and spreadsheets, could discern that I was a fraud, that I could only afford the upgrade because my job covered the rest of my ticket. I may have betrayed myself when the flight attendant asked if I'd like a special drink before takeoff, and I yelled, "A special drink?" and then ordered three. Why just have coffee like some row 26 peasant when you could have coffee, ginger ale, and a mimosa? This, as I'd been assured by the airline industry, was the life. As the flight progressed, first class got less exciting. At some point, once the initial thrill of being adjacent to a four-figure boat sale had worn off, I realized these special drinks weren't remotely special. This roast beef sandwich, though presented with a cloth napkin, was in no way luxurious. Also, sandwich is a rather generous term for a microwaved wad of airborne gray beef. My first-class chair wasn't a plush throne stuffed with Richard Branson's hair, as air travel's mythology would have you believe. It was simply an average-sized chair with a human amount of legroom, as opposed to coach seats, which are novelty-sized file drawers with an elfin amount of legroom. It wasn't unbearable. The highest praise I can give it is that it was adequate. It had succeeded at being a chair, instead of a flying social experiment about the limits of human endurance. The rich aren't paying for luxury, they're paying for basic humanity. For me, the primary advantage of flying first class was that it precluded the dread. I didn't know about the dread until the fall of 2013, the first time I got on a plane and discovered that I didn't quite fit in the seat. I've always been fat, but I was the fat person that still mostly fit. While I couldn't fit into regular lady clothes, more bejeweled tunics covered with skulls, cherries, and antique postage stamps, please. And I had to be careful with butt safety. I once Godzilla'd an entire lunch setting while trying to sidle through a Parisian cafe. I was still the kind of fat person who could move through the straight-sized world without causing too many ripples. Until I couldn't. It had been an incredibly busy year for me professionally. I'd probably flown 20 times in the preceding 8 months. And there's nothing like a steady diet of stress and chilies too to keep the waistline trim. And one day, I sat down, and it just didn't work. I was on a flight home from Texas, and the flight out there had been fine. Suddenly, on the return flight, I had to cram myself in. I mean, I know I ate that brisket, but I was only gone for 2 days. I'm no butt scientist, just 2 credits away, though. But how fast could a person's butt possibly grow? If you've never tried cramming your hips into an angular metal box that's an inch or two narrower than your flesh, under the watchful eye of resentful tourists, then sitting motionless in there for 5 hours while you fold your arms and shoulders up like a dying orchid in order to be as unobtrusive as possible, run, don't walk. It's like squeezing your bones in a vise. The pain makes your teeth ache. I once spent a tearful 8-hour flight from Oslo to Seattle, convinced I could feel my femurs splintering like candy canes. It hurts. Much worse than any physical pain is the anxiety, the dread of walking up the aisle and not knowing what type of plane you're on. Every model has different seat widths and belt lengths, which also vary from airline to airline. Am I going to fit this time? Will I have to ask for a seatbelt extender? Is this a 17-incher or an 18-incher? Is the person next to me going to hate me? Does everyone on this plane hate me? I paid money for this? I have, in my life, been a considerably thinner person and had a fat person sit next to me on a plane. I have also, more recently, been the fat person that makes other travelers' faces fall. Being the fat person is worse. Here's how I board a plane. I do not book a ticket unless I can be assured a window seat. I will happily sit in the very back row or change my flight to the butt crack of dawn, because the window well affords me an extra couple of inches in which to compress my body to give my neighbor as much space as possible. It's awkward and embarrassing to haul and cram myself in and out of the seat, so I also prefer the window because I'm not blocking anyone's bathroom access. I've learned from experience that emergency exit rows and bulkhead rows are often narrower, so those are out. My pre-flight anxiety begins the day before when I remember that I have a trip coming up. I arrive at least 2 hours early, even for domestic flights, to preclude any risk of having to run, because the only thing worse than being fat on a plane is being fat, red, sweaty, and huffing on a plane. I go to the bathroom multiple times before boarding because, again, I avoid getting out of my seat at all cost, even on international flights. The path from fat shaming to deep vein thrombosis is short and slick. I linger by the gate so I can board as early as possible and be the first one in my row. That way, I don't have to make anyone wait in the aisle while I get my body folded up and squared away. As I pass the flight attendants at the front of the plane, I ask discreetly if I can have a seatbelt extender, to minimize the embarrassment of having to ring the call button once I'm seated, and let my seatmates know they're next to the too-big kind of fat person. Finally, I press myself up against the wall like a limpet and try to go to sleep, avoiding any position in which I might snore and remind everyone about my fat, lumpy windpipe. That's the amount of forethought, anxiety, and emotional energy that goes into every single flight. Fat people are not having fun on planes. There is no need to make it worse. Just a month or two after the first time I didn't fit, on a crack of dawn flight from New York City to Seattle, I had my first ever, disagreement with a seatmate. Despite my online irascibility, I am pathologically polite in person, so face-to-face hostility is foreign to me. I'd almost missed the plane. I was that person staggering on board just before the doors closed, and I'm sure this dude thought he was going to have the three-seat row all to himself. He was about my age, maybe mid-30s, an average kind of John Gosselin-looking guy. Probably works in an office, hangs out at, like, an Irish pub because he's too old for clubs but still wants to hit on chicks. Has always wanted to learn to surf but will never get around to it. I don't know, just a guy. I flashed him an apologetic smile and pointed to the middle seat. Hey, sorry, I'm over there. He didn't respond or make eye contact, just glared blankly at my hips. Then, as I went to put my bag in the overhead bin, I heard him mutter something sour. Something, something, say excuse me. I froze. Was someone being a dick to me? In person? At 7 a.m. in an enclosed space for no reason? When I have a hangover? And we're about to be stuck next to each other for the next 5 hours? I'm used to men treating me like garbage virtually, or from fast-moving cars, but this close-quarters face-to-face shit-talking was a jarring novelty. What? I asked. Nothing, he muttered, still refusing to look at me. No, I said. If I'm going to make a living telling women to stick up for themselves, I need to do it too. You said something. What did you say? Nothing, he repeated. No, I repeated. What did you say? Tell me. I said, he snapped, that if you want someone to move, it helps to say, excuse me, and then get out of the way. You told me to move, and then you just... He gestured with a large circular motion at my body. I'm putting my bag in the overhead bin, I said, anxiety thundering in my ears. You know, because that's how planes work. Yeah, he said, dripping with disdain. Okay. He stood up so I could slide into the middle seat, keeping his gaze fixed on the far bank of windows, avoiding eye contact. I sat, trying not to touch him. My head felt like a hot air balloon. I hadn't said excuse me yet because I was still in the process of putting my bag in the overhead bin. The excuse me part of the transaction comes when you ask the other person to get up. I hadn't leaned over him or touched him or dropped anything on him. No eclairs had tumbled out of my cleavage and into his hair. Was a preemptive sorry really not enough? Had I violated some custom I was unaware of? Had I fallen through a tesseract and into a dimension where sorry means no offense, but you have a John Gosselin-esque face and a Kate Gosselin-esque personality? If not, I could not fathom where I'd gone wrong. The last few passengers boarded, and they closed the doors. No one came to claim our window seat, so I slid over, saying, "Looks like there's no one in the middle seat, so you won't actually have to sit next to me, since I apparently bother you so much." "Sounds great to me," he droned, eyes front. As soon as he fell asleep, with his mouth open like a nerd, I passive-aggressively jarred his foot with my backpack and then said, "Oh, excuse me," because I am an adult. And he loves to hear excuse me. We ignored each other for the rest of the flight. It felt alien to be confronted so vocally and so publicly, and for such an arbitrary reason, but it also felt familiar. People say the same kind of thing to me with their eyes on nearly every flight. This guy just chose to say it with his mouth. This is the subtext of my life. You're bigger than I'd like you to be. I dread being near you. Your body itself is a breach of etiquette. You are clearly a fucking fool who thinks that cheesecake is a vegetable. I know that you will fart on me. Nobody wants to sit next to a fat person on a plane. Don't think we don't know. That's why, to return to my first-class flight, my foray into luxury was so disheartening. It wasn't a taste of the high life so much as an infuriating illumination of how dismal it is to fly any other way. I realized, oh, flying first class wasn't intrinsically special, but it was the first time in recent memory that I felt like a human being on a plane. We put up with economy class because most of us have no choice. We need to get from here to there, and we want cheaper and cheaper tickets. I can't blame airlines for trying to stay in business by compressing as many travelers as possible into coach, like a Pringles can lined with meat glue. It seems like a straightforward business decision, which is why it's confusing, as a fat person, to hear so much about how I personally have ruined air travel. There are entire blogs devoted to hating fat people on planes, describing their supposed transgressions and physical particulars in grotesque, gleeful detail, posting clandestine photos and crowing about the verbal abuse that posters claim to have heaped on their bigger neighbors. As though there were a time when, one, there were no fat people, and two, everyone passionately loved flying. As a counterpoint, I would like to lodge a gentle reminder that air travel has been terrible for a long time. It's terrible because a plane is just a flying bus. Trapped in an eternal rush hour, with recycled farts and vaporized child sputum instead of air, seats barely wider than the average human pelvis, and a bonus built-in class hierarchy. Barring a brief period in the 50s and 60s, when airplanes were reportedly flying smoke-choked bacchanals staffed by Bond girls wearing baby onesies, air travel has been a study in discomfort, giving way to ever more profitable methods of making people uncomfortable. That has nothing to do with fat people's bodies. I'm sure some fat people are fat by their own hand, without any underlying medical conditions. But a lot of other fat people are fat because they're sick or disabled. Unless you're checking every human being's blood work before they pull up kayak.com, you do not know which fat people are which. Which means, inevitably, if you think fat people are the problem, and not, say, airlines hoping to squeeze out extra revenue, or consumers who want cheap airline tickets without sacrificing amenities, you're penalizing a significant number of human beings, emotionally and financially, for a disease or disability that already complicates their lives. Ethically, that's fucked up. That dude next to me didn't call me fat to my face. I don't even know if that's what was bothering him, although I recognized the way he looked at my body. My body, not my face, not once, not ever. I can't be sure why that guy was mad at me, but I know why people are usually mad at me on planes. I know that he disliked me instantly, he invented a reason to be a jerk to me, and then he executed it. More importantly, I see other people staring those same daggers at other fat people's bodies every day, in the sky and on the ground, and congratulating themselves for it as though they're doing a righteous public service. Even less popular than being fat on a plane, I soon discovered, was talking about being fat on a plane with anything but groveling, poo-eating penitence. Not long after it happened, I wrote about Say Excuse Me Guy in a little essay for Jezebel about holiday air travel, not expecting anything beyond the usual eat less, exercise more anti-fat backlash. It was a vulnerable story, and a sympathetic one, I thought, about the low-grade hostility that fat people face every day, and about the debilitating self-doubt bred by microaggressions. Does this person really hate me, or am I being oversensitive? And I told it plainly as it happened. I assumed that people could connect with me, the person, and potentially break down some of the prejudice that makes fat people such popular pariahs. The actual response caught me off guard, though it shouldn't have. Without considering for a moment that I might have interpreted my own experiences accurately, that this very simple and famously common interaction, an airplane passenger feeling resentful about sitting next to a fat person, might be true, readers bent over backwards to construct elaborate alternate narratives in which I was the villain. I was the one being rude by saying sorry instead of excuse me. What rule is that? I had smothered him with my gut when I reached up to stow my bag. Ew, as if I like touching people. I had delayed the flight with my entitled, irresponsible failure to show up on time. I was there within the boarding window, I just wasn't early the way I like to be. I was the last person on the plane. Nope. I was still drunk, looking for a fight, ranting and raving and reeking of booze. What do I look like, a freshman? In the same breath that commenters were telling me I was overreacting, I was delusional, I was lying. A man couldn't possibly have been hostile to me on an airplane. They were also chiming in with and commiserating over their own anecdotes about the horrors of flying near disgusting, smelly, presumptuous fat people. So which is it? Are fat people treated just fine on planes? Or is flying with fat people such a torment that it warrants a public crusade? Part of writing is choosing which details to include and which to discard. Part of reading is deciding whether or not you can trust your narrator. The internet made it very clear, very quickly, once my post went up, that trusting me was not on the table. I didn't bother to mention, for instance, that the dude was sitting with his legs splayed wide in classic man-steaming-balls-coming-through fashion, with his foot in the middle footwell, my footwell, where I'd stowed my backpack. If I had, I would have been accused of feminist hysteria the way women who call out subway manspreading have been. I didn't waste words on the fact that when they closed the cabin doors and it became clear that our window seat was going to be unoccupied, I moved my backpack to the window seat where I'd already been sitting. So yeah, I jostled the guy's foot when I moved my bag because the guy's foot was blocking my bag. The guy didn't even wake up. I thought it was tedious and unnecessary exposition, and if you're still awake at this point in this boring-ass paragraph, you'll see that I was right. I assumed that Jezebel readers would trust that I am as I have always presented myself, a kind, pragmatic, nonviolent, reasonable human being, and read my story with a modicum of empathy, or at least the benefit of the doubt. Within hours of my post cycling through the internet sausage factory, I was barraged with bizarre fictions on Twitter. I had stumbled onto the plane drunk, delayed takeoff as I screamed at the guy to move, sat on him, viciously kicked him with my wide calf boot, brutally beaten him with my backpack, continued to harass and mock him for the duration of the flight as he quivered in terror and pretended to sleep, then eagerly libeled him on the internet. One particularly putrid community of misogynists threatened to report me to the FBI for assault and battery in a federal airspace. LOL, go for it, sluggers. They also coordinated a temporarily successful effort to Google bomb my name so that their article, Fat Feminist Lindy West Goes Berserk Because She No Longer Fits in Airplane Seats, came up on the first page of search results. Here's an excerpt from that totally reasonable and not at all bigoted because fat phobia isn't a real thing reaction to my article, sick throughout. Quote, "Is this who we want having influence in our country? Society must realize that there are consequences to fat feminist beliefs. They range from the concrete, not fitting on airplanes, to creating a class of perennial female victims seekers who have no notion of personality responsibility. Instead of focusing on self-improvement, they seek to blame everyone else for their problems, even innocent men on airplanes who have their property damaged from the cankled legs of deranged women." On a different site, a commenter wrote, "Man, fuck her! I wouldn't want to stoop to feminist levels and wish bodily harm, castration slash acid burning her face, etc. on her, but if I did, then I'd say I wish that Buffalo Bill taught her a lesson or two." And another, "My God, what a putrid and deluded fucking cunt. I'm so glad that her health decisions that are none of my business will see her in an early grave. I'm sure when she loses her legs from diabetes or has a heart attack at 40 due to lard-clogged arteries, that will be the patriarchy's fault too, bitch." Very astute, boys. I was probably just imagining the whole thing. I'm certainly not an adult human being who's been successfully reading social cues for 30 years. And we certainly don't have any evidence of general animosity toward fat people, particularly fat people on planes. Before the day I didn't fit, this conversation was largely an abstraction for me. My stance was the same as it is now. If people pay for a service, it is the seller's obligation to accommodate those people and provide the service they paid for. But I didn't understand what that panicky, uncertain walk down the aisle actually felt like. How inhumane it is. I'm telling you this not to garner sympathy or pity, or even to change your opinion about how airplanes should accommodate larger passengers. I'm just telling you, human to human, that life is complicated and fat people are trying to live, same as you. Reasons I have had to fly within the past 5 years. For work, often. To see beloved friends get married. To speak to college students about rape culture and body image. To hold my father's hand while he died. I'm sorry, but I'm not constraining and rearranging my life just because no one cares enough to make flying accessible to all bodies. Airlines have no incentive to fix this problem until we collectively as a society demand it. We don't insist on a solution because it's still culturally acceptable to be cruel to fat people. When even pointing out the problem, saying, "My body does not fit in these seats that I pay for," returns nothing but abuse and scorn, how can we ever expect that problem to be addressed? The real issue here isn't money, it's bigotry. We don't care about fat people because it is okay not to care about them, and we don't take care of them because we think they don't deserve care. It's the same lack of care that sees fat people dying from substandard medical attention, being hired at lower rates and convicted at higher ones, and being accused of child abuse for feeding their children as best they can. You can't fix a problem by targeting its victims. Even if you hate fat people with all your heart, if you actually want to get us out of your armrest space, defending our humanity is the only pragmatic solution. Because no matter how magnificently you resent them, you cannot turn a fat person into a thin person in time for the final boarding call, nor a full bladder into an empty one, nor a crying baby into a baked potato. The only answer is to decide we're worth helping. Chuckletown, USA. Population. Jokes. For my junior year English requirement in high school, I took a class called Autobiography because it was taught by my favorite teacher. I didn't have anything remotely noteworthy to say about myself. Today after basketball, I tried red Powerade instead of blue Powerade, but I think I'll switch back tomorrow. I don't know. I am also considering Mandarin Blast, A Life by Lindy West. Nor was I particularly interested at the time in reading the memoirs of others. I read this entire book about Florence Griffith Joyner, and it did not contain a single